Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Just after getting airborne, one of the blades, the LP-1 blade, with all the energy it could ever have, separated. For as far as I was concerned, we were upside down, and there was no out. There's no one to talk to. This was all within 1 or 2 seconds. So I have a choice at that point. It's either land upside down, which is going to be unsurvivable, or eject.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello and welcome to Aviation Extended. I'm Tim Robinson, and joining me on this episode is my co-host Gareth Stringer.
Hi Tim, you all right?
Yeah, very good, thank you. So it's been turning out to be an absolute bumper year for aviation aerospace books. So I'm particularly thrilled to have on the show the author of a new book, Hazard Spectrum, Commander Nathan Gray, former Harrier, ETPS, US Navy Pax River flight test grudger, and F-35 test pilot. He's one of the Royal Navy's top guns. Having just finished it, it's a cracking read that grabs you, doesn't let you go. Welcome to Extended, Nathan.
Hi, Tim. Hi, Gareth. Thanks for having me on.
Brilliant. Well, we're absolutely stoked to have you on the show, and really fantastic to have you chat about the book. I mean, like I said, I read it, and wow, first chapter in especially. So before we get on to the start, on to the book's contents, hopefully avoid too many spoilers. What inspired you to write this book in the first place?
Well, it was wanting to get the message out there about aviation, about how, you know, it sits on a spectrum. It's hazardous, it's dangerous, but it's achievable. You know, it's achievable for all. So I wanted to talk about my career. It's got some highs, it's got some very, very lows. It's exciting. I think it's a roller coaster. It takes us, you know, to war zones. It takes us through academic test pilot school, and it takes us to F-35 and the most cutting edge technology out there. So I wanted to get that message out, and I wanted to tell the story.
Great stuff. So one of the things we've got in common is visits to a certain museum in Hanley to see a Spitfire in a big glass house. It's like a gardening shed, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's like a big greenhouse.
Greenhouse, yeah. And so you grew up just down from the river in Stoke-on-Trent, and one of the things that resonated with me, your background, and what was the kind of class aspect of, you know, you had applied a few times to the RAF, hadn't you? And then you went on to the Royal Navy. So can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, with the Spitfire just outside the museum there in Hanley in Stoke-on-Trent being brought up, walking past it most weekends for the family shopping trip, and also being, you know, hugely lucky enough to have the Boeing NASA's 747 fly overhead with the space shuttle on the back. That kind of gave the inspiration in very, very early years to want to fly a plane. But then I do remember, you know, at school, standard secondary school in the middle of Stoke-on-Trent, we had a careers lesson, and the careers teacher asked us all to go away and think of a job that we'd want to do in the future, or a career, more a job actually. And I came back and said I want to be a pilot, and was very very sternly told that's not what people from around here go on to do. So go away and think about something else. So I didn't. I may have kept it quiet and continued on that path. But yeah, I applied a few times to the RAF. You know, inspired by the likes of John Peters, John Nicol, Tornado Down. It was the Gulf War era. Top Gun also had just come out. So all those things that I think it's very rare to find a pilot who's not inspired by those stories.
But the FAA were more welcoming, would it be sort of fair to say? You felt at home there?
Yeah. The Fleet Air Arm, it was fortuitous, really, because I'd applied to the Air Force once again and been accepted. And so I phoned the Royal Navy. This was at the end of university, trying to find a career or have a career in aviation. And the Royal Navy, I phoned the Navy to cancel the interview. And they said, well, if you've cast your rail warrant in at Stoke-on-Trent Station, then you'll have to pay us back. And that, you know, that at the time, that was a huge amount of money. I think it was about 30 or 40 pounds, and it wasn't something I had. and the very insightful lady on the end of the telephone, HMS Sultan, said to me, okay, well, why don't you just jump on the plane? On the plane. Why don't you just jump on the train and come on down? And it's, you know, 3 days. You've been through interviews like this before anyway with the RAF. It's free accommodation. It's good food. And just see how you go. And then you don't have to pay it back. So I did. And it was enlightening to go through questioning, to go through all the physical tasks, all the things that the Navy do at their Admiralty Interview Board. And actually, it just felt right.
You put your reading material, was it loaded and labs mag, so I got away with it.
Yeah, well, I may as well just tell, you know, be completely open and honest and tell the truth. With the Air Force, I had to say, it was one of the main broadsheets. And then they would go down, you know, and drill down into, well, who's the editor, who's the military correspondent. Whereas the Royal Navy, I completely open and honest, yeah, I like reading loaded. There were three people interviewing me: a headmaster, a captain, and a commander aviator. And the commander just looked over and smiled, and the headmaster turned around and said, "Is loaded? Is that for rich people?" There were no idea what it was, but the pilot sat on his shoulder. He certainly knew what it was. He gave me a knowing smile.
Fantastic.
Just occurred to me, Nathan. That might have been the first sort of sliding doors moment. That phone call down to the fleet tower, but it certainly wasn't the last, was it?
No,
it's funny the way things match up and fall into place. It's funny, isn't it, when you look back at life like that?
Yeah, there were definitely several avenues that life could have taken all of us, I'm sure.
So that obviously brings us on to the details of. So you were fresh out of training on the Harrier, going through instruction at Wittering, where and this is the chapter that starts off the book, utterly gripping. Obviously, the reader knows to survive, all for survives, but it's written in such a way that you're thinking, gosh, if the ground is above you, how is the author going to get out of this? So, I mean, is that still fresh in your mind, or did it need lots of prompting? You were in the two-seat Harrier in Wittering in 2002.
Yeah, no, it didn't need any shaking of the grey matter. It was all there at the forefront. The emotions, not so much. They were definitely buried deep down, so it was rather cathartic to go through the whole process. But yeah, I was a student on the Harrier, so been lucky enough to be selected once all the training was over to go onto the single seat Harrier, and it was the Sea Harrier with the Royal Navy, the Fleet Air Arm. And during the very early stages, you go to RAF Wittering, which is basically the playground for Harrier training, with lots of small, short strips. Everything the Harrier was designed for, grass runways, little pads, ski jumps, woods that you can take off and land in. So it really was the playground for Harrier pilots to learn their bread and butter. So I was there, and it was my 16th flight. So I'd just learned how to hover, just really learned how to take off and land. And now I was learning how to put the aircraft, take off from short strips and land on short strips as well. That's something they called the rolling vertical landing. So I was flying with the most well-known and best fighter pilot that we had, Jack London. He was one of our senior instructors, sat in the back of our Harrier T8. We'd done a takeoff. We were slightly heavy on fuel, so Harrier was performance limited. So we burnt a little bit of fuel in the overhead, landed again on the taxiway, and then prepared for another takeoff to start the main exercise. And it was on that takeoff at full power, just after getting airborne, that one of the blades, the LP1 blade, so right at the front of the engine, with all the energy it could ever have, separated. It turns out it was from a minute piece of FOD that hit the stem of the blade, and the blade came off. It hit a titanium ring, which the designers put into the engine on the Harrier to stop it going into the fuel tanks, because the intake were actually fuel tanks as well, which is a clever design. But then the blade got sucked back through the engine, and then damaged all the blades. All the blades separated straight through the fuel tanks. Tragically and unfortunately, hit the control rod of the aircraft, and gave the aircraft just at that moment full right roll, spinning the aircraft over to the right, correcting to the left. Didn't do anything because we're airborne purely because of the jets at that point, not because of the jet engine thrust, not because of the aerodynamics. There are no aerodynamics at that point with the Harrier because you're taking off so slow. And then all that thrust is gone now because the engine's just disintegrated. So full left stick, nothing. The aircraft rolled upside down, went from 50 feet up to about 100 feet and then back down to 50 feet. And that the communications were lost. A huge pressure wave ran through the cockpit, and the front of the cockpit was lit up like a Christmas tree with every imaginable warning and caution. And the head-up display, the thing that gives you your biggest SA in jet aviation, had gone. So, as far as I was concerned, we were upside down. And there was no out. There's no one to talk to. And this all happens, I think the chapter may take several minutes to read, but this was all within 1 or 2 seconds. I look up through the top of the canopy, and all I can see is the grass, the runway and the grass verge. So, and I think it's time, it's gone past the time that I could have ejected. So I have a choice at that point. It's either land upside down, which is going to be unsurvivable, or eject. And I just think this is the right thing to do. This is what I've been told to do, so I'll do it. It's, as I thought at the time, pointless, but I'll give it a go. So, but I do think, I better make sure I do it properly. I don't pull my kneeboard or pull the wrong handle. So I look down, see the handle, pull it with my right hand, completely in the wrong ejection posture, and the next thing I know, my head is thrust down underneath the seat, and I can see the rockets firing, and then it all goes grey. It's not unconsciousness; it's grey out. Mm-hmm. So I've still got my conscious state, but my eyes, they're wide open, but I just can't see anything. It's just grey as the blood's moved down my body. So I sense the freezing cold temperature, because you've just left your air conditioned cockpit into the December weather. So straight into the air, and I apparently was left at, or I left the cockpit at 89 degrees, so just above the horizon. I went shooting, shooting across the barbed wire fence of the perimeter. And all the time, I'm desperately, I can't work out what do I want to see, what I'm about to be impaled on, because as far as I'm concerned, I'm about to hit the ground. And can I see it? Can't I see it? Can I see it? Can't I see it? Do I want to see it? And you're in this kind of this real gray zone where you know you're about to die. So what's your choice? Do you want to see it? What's going to kill you, or don't you? Do you want to keep your eyes closed? And then at that moment, I felt a tug on my back. My eyesight suddenly returned, and I hit the ground. And I'd landed in a freshly ploughed, soft farmer's field. And sadly, tragically, my instructor Jack, he ejected as well, seemingly about the same time, but just a few milliseconds difference, and he left at about 91, 92 degrees, and he did go sit straight into the ground, and sadly we lost our legendary fighter pilot from the fleet of Aeron. And so, there we were. We were both lying fairly closely together on the ground at Wittering. So that's the, that kind of is the benchmark for my career, really.
There's a couple of things here, Nathan. The first thing I just want to say, and I'm almost certain the same thing is going through Tim's mind now, to read it in the book was gripping. I've sat here with goosebumps hearing you tell the story, to watch you now. Everyone's listening to this on audio, but the three of us can all see each other. And that's, thank you for doing that. You know, the clarity that you can relate this story, which is such an important part of your tale, but also Jack's tale. Yeah. He was a legend. And that's, and again, we don't want to spoil all the book, but if you don't know about Jack London, you'll know a lot about him from your book and how loved and important he was. The second thing I think for me, and that there's this guilt that comes with surviving something like that when someone doesn't. It's something that, as some people know me, I also experienced an accident where I obviously survived, but other people didn't. Just that's a thread really that runs through the book, and it runs through your life. It's important to you, isn't it? And it's something that I know has left its mark. It's something that now I feel I've turned into a positive thing in my life. It wasn't a positive thing for a long time, and being a sort of typical bloke, it took me quite a long time to actually even admit that it existed. Just tell us a little bit about that and how that influenced your career and up to this day.
Yeah, I mean, it's survivor guilt. It's there. I mean, it's there. It's there now, and it'll continue, until the end of our days. It's painful. It's painful to think about the emotions. Like I said, the journey was cathartic to write those first two chapters about the accident. Opening the box, opening the lid, like you said, on those emotions. It comes with time. It came with maturity as well, where you're a lot more aware of your emotions. And ultimately, did take though 20 years or so to really, I won't say fully understand. I'm not entirely sure that'll ever happen.
No, agreed.
Yeah, and it kind of sits also then side by side with this kind of imposter syndrome as well. It's survivor guilt. It's imposter syndrome. It's questioning why on earth you're still here. And why you're still doing what you're, or being allowed to do what you're doing, when there are others around you who sadly can't. So, I mean, it leaves you. It does leave you feeling incredibly lucky and privileged at every turn. So that's if there is a positive out of it, that's one of them.
We interviewed Tug Wilson about his two. Tug's written two books: one about being a Phantom pilot in the Air Force, and the second one about being a flying instructor in the Air Force. And Tug and I talked a lot about imposter syndrome. He says in his Phantom book, he kept thinking at some point someone's going to point at me and say, "What on earth are you doing? You can't do this. You know, you're not good enough for this."
Well, I thought somebody was going to say that to me as I was hobbling alongside HMS Queen Elizabeth to explain to the first landing. So I'm just within earshot now for somebody to actually call me out on this.
Brilliant. Anyway, we digress slightly, but thank you for that. It is the most extraordinary start to a book. And I actually think it's the first time I've got to the end of like a chapter one. I actually thought, right, I'm just going to have to put this down for a minute. This is exhausting.
Yes, same here. I needed a few minutes after that as well. So, amazingly, you got back into the saddle. You finished Harrier. You know, you were given the option as, do you want to go and do something else? And you kept on the training. You want to fly fast jets. You want to fly the Harrier. Then went on to Afghanistan with Joint Force Harrier, hunting Osama bin Laden and dropping warheads on foreheads, as the Americans say. So tell us a bit about that, and also tell us a bit, what did your other pilots think of you using the aircraft itself as a melee weapon?
Well, first of all, yes, I got back in the cockpit. I was surrounded by some fantastic people. Some fly instructors and mentors that were, off the scale when it comes to understanding sensitivity and encouragement. So it's thanks to them that I got, and obviously my family, that I got back in the cockpit and continued. And successfully moved on to the GR7 with Joint Force Harrier, and then Afghanistan. It was tough and very different to the training that we do, the lifestyles that we lead, and the decisions that you have to make. You kind of imagine a fighter pilot world, which is a fairly sterile environment. You know, it's you against a bogey. It's 2v4 or what have you, but this was supporting all the guys and girls on the ground that are your colleagues, your friends, who are being shot at and people are trying to kill them. So it was a very, very different world to what we'd all been trained for, and it was tough. Quite regularly you'd be airborne and within 20 minutes you've used up all your weapons to try and protect the guys on the ground, leaving you with this airplane that's full of fuel but with no weapons. And so depending on what's going on the ground, it leaves you with two choices. Either try and do what you can, sometimes that's fly low, make some noise for the guys that are down there at that moment in time, or fly back as quick as you can, where there'll be another aircraft that's all bombed up, fueled up for you, that you can literally land, jump out of that cockpit, straight into the new cockpit and go again. So it was just very different to, I think anything really that was reported on as well. It wasn't that sterile environment that we kind of believe exists in the aviation world. It was effectively you were part of those small four-man teams or troops or brigades who were going to do the job on the ground. So, yeah, and we're all very much in it together. Absolutely.
You'd at some point you decided that you had troops in contact and you decided to use the aeroplane as a weapon itself. Which got reported on, tell us the story, a little bit of the story anyway.
So we were in a quite big fight on the ground. There was an ambush. The Royal Marines had managed to egress and set up a position ready to go back in again, at which point they realised they were missing three members. So we searched frantically for these three guys. And in the end, and in the process of withdrawing and a few other skirmishes, effectively expended all of our weapons. So at that point, that I have nothing. The noise generally would calm the situation down, because everybody on the ground would hear there's a jet overhead and would know to keep the head down and stay low. That wasn't the case. So then left with a choice. Well, I can either RTB, so return to base and leave the guys, which means the noise disappears, which generally means the re-attack's going to happen, or stay on station, keep providing that noise, that footprint, and then do whatever I can to try and stop the advancing Taliban going towards where our potentially three hostages and the troops were. So yeah, so I got as low as I possibly could, and extended my speed brake, my air brake from underneath the aircraft in an attempt to just try and do something rather than going home. And so I did. I flew down as low as the Radalt in the day would indicate, cancelling all the warnings, and went in to just do whatever I could with whatever I had available. Yeah.
Good grief. is there a fun video of this? What did your mate say? What did your mate say when you came? I mean, presumably this was spent round the Joint Force Harrier like wildfire.
Well, I mean, there were other other things that some other events that happened that were just as headline newsworthy, I guess. But I think everybody understood, and when I say everybody, I mean there were only six pilots,
yeah.
Sometimes seven, sometimes eight, depending on if there's a handover. But that's effectively all we were. So very quickly, you have a debrief first off with the intelligence officer, and then with the rest of your mates over coffee. Everybody agreed that's exactly what they would have done in that scenario. I still have that snapshot very clear in my mind of three guys making a running symbol, going straight across my field of view, going across a small bridge. So that's now etched in my head.
Did you know that the RP-3 rocket projectile, used to great effect by Hawker Typhoons in the tank-busting ground attack role, was originally conceived as an air-to-air weapon to attack Luftwaffe bomber streams? Did you also know that in the 1950s, an indigenous light aircraft built in the Philippines was skinned with woven bamboo matting? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
The other part of your career, test pilot school. So that was another sort of bit of serendipity, I suppose, in the case that people in the Navy kept hinting at you that you should go to test pilot school, and we haven't had any candidates, and why the heck aren't you applying?
How did you leave Linton? How did you leave Linton, though, Nate? Linton was gorgeous. What a place to be. Yeah.
Very true. You couldn't ask for a better place, could you? I think, I love Linton. I love being
a proper RAF base.
Fast jet flying instructor living on the patch, behind the wire. It was, it's like stepping back 50 or 60 years. Beautiful part of the world and great job, especially teaching, all the up and coming fighter pilots who are now all doing the business on the front line. So love that. But to then be and I was pestered a few times by my careers officer asking me to go to France or go here and go there, because the Navy the Navy didn't really necessarily see that role as a trailblazing position. So they had other ideas for me. But then to meet the incoming commanding officer of Empire Test Pilot School, and to chat to him and to realize that this role exists, there's a possibility, you know, back then, 2010, 11, F-35, you know, Queen Elizabeth carriers, that they weren't really on our minds at all. We just had our Harrier chopped, so and the carriers. So we knew it wasn't just around the corner. So to be told, well, now is the time to start preparing for the F-35, especially when it comes to testing, because it is being flown as we speak. Why don't you become a test pilot? Your background, aerospace engineering degree, all points towards it. Why don't you go and give it a go? And boy, the interview process was tough.
there was some pretty horrendous academics involved in that process as well, weren't there?
Yeah, the academics for selection was tough enough, but the course itself, it's PhD. You're trying to work really hard on the academic side, whilst also moving your desk effectively and your calculator and all the other bits, Excel spreadsheets, into a cockpit and flying a new jet that you've never flown before, knowing all the limits, knowing how to fly it. It's mind blown. And then obviously spending every waking hour writing a report on it. It's a challenging course, but you understand, it really gets you to understand aviation, you know, aerodynamics, the interface between the designers, the engineers and the pilots. It's wonderful course.
It would be very interesting. Those of us of a certain age will remember the BBC's test pilot series, which I think came on 86, 87, something like that. It'd be really interesting to see how much technology has possibly changed the training of a test pilot now, and also the role of the test pilots. I always remember, and this is because I was lucky enough to work with him at the time of the Harrier's retirement, but I always remember they got John Farley on episode one of that series. Mm-hmm. And I distinctly remember him saying, the job of a test pilot in the 1980s is exactly the same as it was in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. Yeah, it hasn't changed. I wonder if another 30-odd, 40 years later, whether that's still true now with all the technology that we've got available to us.
You see, I think it is true. I mean, test pilot school, although, you know, on the outer surface changes, you know, the aircraft that you fly, you know, maybe some of the technology that you test, that changes, but the fundamentals, they don't change. The physics of how an aeroplane flies, and how you can improve it, the handling qualities, you know, the performance, all those things, they all stay the same. That underlying mathematics and calculus, it's all still there and hasn't changed in the slightest. Flight control laws, you know, the flight control systems of modern aircraft, they have changed, but the way you test them, that it's changed slightly, but the methodology that goes behind that hasn't. And the fact that you're a gate guardian, you know, you're the gatekeeper for most of the time from these billion-dollar programs to the front line. You're the person who tests the aircraft to say whether this is acceptable, whether it's fit for purpose. That again, that hasn't changed from the 30s, 40s. It remains true, and sometimes it's hard.
Just rewinding. So obviously we touched on F-35 gearing up to FO. So just rewinding slightly, because you were in the US on exchange with US Marine Harrier Squadron while that shock decision came in of, I don't know, UK is going back to F-35C, and you know the higher ups said Brits go home. In fact, what was that like?
Yeah, that was a bizarre period of my career, and a bizarre actions as well. You know, we're serving overseas on an exchange tour. Yeah, it, it was like the rug had been pulled from underneath, I think, for every certainly Harrier pilot, if not naval aviation in total. You know, rug had been pulled from under our feet. But then to add on top of that, the fact that we'd changed to the C variant, which, you know, wasn't necessarily the wrong decision, but we then had somehow aggrieved the US Marine Corps because we turned our back on the B variant, and then yeah, to be told get out.
One of your, you know, your most illustrious predecessor, and I think you know who I'm talking about here, Captain Eric Winkle Brown. I mean, yes. He got sent home early. I don't know if you read Winkle, Paul Beamer's book on.
I haven't read it just yet. No, I have got it though.
Okay, but he got sent home early from Pax River because he was testing a shape that he wasn't cleared for, and he apparently reported it back to Ministry of Defence back in the UK, and the US were listening to our cables.
Okay.
And he got told to pack his bags and got sent home, which is kind of interesting. So Pax River, you were at Pax River as well, which is obviously amazing experience there, US Naval Test Pilot School. So what was the highlights there? You also aced the program, the course. I mean, there's three prizes and you pulled off a hat trick, was it a dissertation on Strike Eagle?
Yeah. My final project was on the F-15E, the Strike Eagle, which again had plenty of caveats to it because it was it's a frontline US fighter aircraft. So there were only so many systems that I could turn on and play with and report on. But yeah, it was the F-15 and then best overall student. So US Navy Test Pilot School was intense. But unbelievable the number of aircraft that you get to fly and all the different experiences that you get to go through. I think the highlights are flying the Albatross just outside Las Vegas, flying over the Hoover Dam, landing on the Hoover Dam, shutting down, going for a little swim, and then jumping back in again. All whilst doing the finest flight testing and checking the handling qualities of this aeroplane come boat. Other highlights are flying the NASA Space Shuttle Profile. Over at Edwards Air Force Base, and you're using the lake bed there. Flying the F-16, going supersonic, in the same airspace run as Chuck Yeager. And ultimately all the different aircraft, the MiG-15, the T-38 was our mainstay, the Talon, which we qualified on, and the F-18. So yeah, a whole list of aircraft, more than I can mention. Some that are very hard to fly, some that are very easy to fly, but all really good fun to fly.
Putting your imposter syndrome to one side, is there a point at which you stopped feeling like a fighter pilot and you thought, I'm a test pilot now?
I think that actually occurred on the F-35 during the Queen Elizabeth class trials, during the first class flight trials, because then you've obviously done lots of testing, you've qualified, but you haven't yet proven your mettle. You haven't yet done something that's been watched by millions that, you know, can go disastrously wrong, but doesn't because of the fantastic team that you've got around you. So yeah, it's really strangely towards the end of my career that I actually started to be able to say, yes, I might be able to do this.
So tell us about your impressions of the F-35 as a war fighting machine aircraft. I mean, your first flight, I think you ended up with the HMD wasn't properly aligned in one eye. Yeah. There's been other things where communications have gone down, even the final landing, I think, was a bit eventful with it designed to reboot in flight. So, what's it like to fly?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'll just caveat that, you know, all of the exciting things that happened for me on an F-35, it's all because it's experimental, you know, it's developmental. Our job is to make the high risk, the dangerous stuff look really boring and mundane to everybody on the outside. That's when a good flight test has been successful. So yeah, the F-35, it is a mass of lethality. Every bit of it is a sensor. Every bit of it is built for a purpose and not added on to as a compensatory method of, you know, because the flying quality isn't quite right or what have you. It's been specifically designed for a purpose, and it achieves that purpose impeccably. So, you know, having flown the variants, you know, the B variants, and every aircraft is a compromise, you know, and the A, B, and the C variants are very different. They're designed to fly mostly the same, but the B variant, you know, with its stovall capability is unbelievable in the things that it will allow us to do now and in the future. And then the A variant and especially the C variant, they all look very similar from a photo, but when you put them all side by side, the C variant is huge, with an undercarriage that can even take one of my landings. So it's built to last, put it that way. Yeah, but it's a fantastic aeroplane. So from start to finish, from the designers all the way through to, you know, us test pilots who are the gate guardians that then push it out to the front line. We had one sole focus, and that is to give the warfighters the best aircraft we possibly could, and I think we've achieved that.
And just going back to John Farley again, because obviously he was the famously said it's better to stop and land than to land and stop. So he was all in favour of a button that says take me home. But was it a difficult transition coming from the Harrier, where it's very manual and you're constantly adjusting stuff to being sat in a thing where you can program in a like forward speed, and it will keep the, you know, it will just sort of, you know, come along the ship and just sort of be there and just happily hover, and you can go hands off and the flight control system, you know.
The transition for a Harrier pilot to an F-35 is much harder than it is for any other pilot to fly an F-35B variant. Yeah, because we are, you know, as a Harrier pilot, you're very used to your hands bouncing between the throttle, the nozzles, and then your feet are always working hard, and obviously on the control column as well. There's always movement, and you're always scanning, and it's always got some surprise for you. Whereas the F-35, we designed that out, so you know you now effectively could go hands off stick and throttle, and the aircraft would quite happily hold its position, whatever position you've told it to. Obviously, as a test pilot, we test that it does that, and sometimes it you know, the ones and the zeros weren't quite right. So when you say you sit quite happily in the hover, it wasn't quite like that, but it is now, which is important. It's a very different beast. I'd often find myself hovering in a, you know, when we're testing the extremes of the envelope, certainly alongside the ship, and the winds come in, you know, full crosswind, it's a huge amount of knots, and it's got its interactions as well with the superstructure of the carrier. So depending on which spot you're going to, you get different vortices, and you certainly, when things don't go quite right, you have to sit on your hands as a Harrier pilot, because you could very quickly go back to muscle memory. Which is 180 out with this control system of what you need to do to correct the issue. So, but it gives you that lenience. It gives you those few seconds to be able to go, okay, I would pull back. No, I won't do that now. No, I do this with this aircraft, and it gives you that luxury. So, flying around the boat, doing any kind of stovall maneuver in the F-35 is really good fun. It's a joy. Whereas with the with the Harrier, the moment you get in that cockpit and launch off the ship, you're instantly thinking in the back of your mind about the recovery. Whereas with the F-35, you don't need to do that. You know that it's going to be, you'd like to think it's going to be fairly benign.
So tell us about the historic first landing on HMS Queen Elizabeth, 2018. I think, like we said in the intro, the whole world was watching with excitement. People were on Twitter. People were looking at it. Everyone was waiting for this big historic milestone for the Royal Navy to get back in the game. So just tell us a bit
other point, Nathan, as well, just on the back of that. The first time I met John Farley, I was very lucky to meet him at Dunsfold. As one of the events leading up to the retirement, but unfortunately, OC4 and Steve Kenworthy couldn't get their Harriers in because we were fogged out completely. So I ended up chatting to John Farley for ages. So no issues there. But one of the things he told me that day was that military test flying is best carried out nice and quietly away from the public eye. And that was, that was the best thing about Dunsfold, he said, is that no one really paid any attention to what they were doing there. I mean, you didn't have the benefit of that, did you? Certainly not on that day, anyway.
No, not on that day. On other days, Patrick, there are certain areas that are very very discreet, and the same goes for over in Edwards and the Mojave Desert. There are some nice quiet areas where you can do some various test manoeuvres. But no, on that day, the whole world was watching. There was nowhere to hide. So, but actually, funnily enough, we were delayed. It doesn't matter how much money you throw at it, how good the technology is, no matter how important it is, we were fogged out. We were delayed by a couple of hours. So Mother Nature doesn't necessarily care about the number of people number of VIPs that have been flown on board to watch this event. We launched, went over to the carrier, and just looking down, it only really hit me the importance of the landing, or the return of carrier aviation actually for the Royal Navy in the UK. Once we got sight of the carrier, we could look down, see the carrier with its escort ship alongside, and then realize that actually that this is very important. For an island nation, it's wholly criminal that we haven't had it for, I think, 10 years or so. But we have, this is the moment it's back. So, then the pressure really piled on. I could definitely feel my bald head getting hot inside that helmet. even hotter. It transpires as I came around a couple of times on low passes just to make sure that the vortices and everything appeared to be as we'd done these landings and launches of the whole entire envelope thousands of times in the simulator, so we thought we knew what it was going to be like, but computer modeling is only as good as the ones and zeros that you put in there. So that's why flight test is so important, because you have to check what the truth data is and what reality is. So a couple of fly throughs, but each time on the fly through, the communications were fine with the ship, but we have hot mic, so a live microphone going comms link straight to the flight test engineers in the ship. And each aircraft had about 40 engineers or so, all watching every single parameter that the aircraft is pumping out. So we have hydraulics, we have fuel, we have propulsion, we have landing gear, flight control system, handling qualities, flight qualities. We have every single discipline all sat there. But that link, even though we tested it, and obviously we couldn't exactly land, this is the first time we've got an aircraft close to a carrier, to the carrier. So we couldn't test it. You'd like to think you get rid of all the risk and all the possibilities, but this is the one bit that we couldn't quite guarantee. And it came to bear. We had this intermittent comms link. So I would normally be talking normally and giving a running commentary that was in and out. And I didn't know that, but the flight test engineers did. And so we struggled. We struggled out to use all the different communications channels, the several buttons that we've got on the throttle to be able to speak to every man and his dog to get the aircraft on the ground. But we were successful. It was monumental. It was a huge relief to get on the deck, and more importantly to see that we hadn't caused any damage. There were unknowns. What's the aircraft? The thrust is immense coming out the back end of the jet. What's that going to do as it crosses the carrier? All the lifeboats, all the things that hang on the side of the carrier. Is it just going to completely decimate it? What's it going to do to this new deck that we've paid lots of money for to be thermally heat treated and protected? What's it going to do to that? Because we haven't, this is the moment of truth when we put rubber to deck. It worked. It was very, in hindsight, it was the handling of the aircraft was unemotional, but having the engineers, we're doing test points. We're not just flying around for fun. So it's all about collecting data and having that data to prove that the aircraft is safe and fit for purpose. And those links were in and out, and that's one of our biggest risk mitigators. And that was intermittent. So it was challenging. Continued to be for that whole evolution of then the launch, first launch, where they were unsure about the stresses and strains that went into the undercarriage, because that ramp certainly puts the undercarriage under a huge amount of strain, and then coming back to round to land, unsure of what it had done to the undercarriage. It turns out it'd done nothing. But we couldn't know that. So the last thing we wanted to do was leave this F-35 in a heap on the deck. That would not have been a successful day. It was a gentle landing to applause and congratulations all around. It was a good day.
We'll leave anyone who hasn't read the book, but there's a great line. Did somebody email or wire back to the UK to say that you'd successfully completed the test? And there was a brilliant message that came back, wasn't there? But you'll find that in the book.
I think the emotions were high. Didn't matter where you were on which continent, they were high.
And you had the world's media there as well. You had some of the world's media there as well on board ship, who were monitoring it and under embargo, I believe, because we've got kind of a funny story here from people watching on Twitter of a Twitter fight that broke out between people who were on the ship, a couple of outlets. I'm not going to name names, but people could probably guess. And I think it was probably Sky News who weren't on the ship, but had got a picture that appeared on somewhere else on Twitter of the launch. And then there was a whole fisticuffs on Twitter about what an embargo is who was respecting the embargo and all the rest of it. Big defense news. And the funniest thing I remember from it was, obviously, it was time for the 6 o'clock news in the UK. And unfortunately, on the 6 o'clock news, I watched the 6 o'clock. I'm going to watch the news now. It had been dropped because there was some sort of US judge or something in the US. Oh gosh, I can't remember. The Supreme Court, who was I don't know, either got himself into mischief or there was anyway. So it was just dropped off the news on the 6 o'clock news, which was, kind of, it was just funny from my point of view of not being on the ship.
This is the real deal.
Fear of missing out of being an aviation journalist and then, amazing. Fantastic stuff. So one of the things that as well, so you had your last flight in F-35. That was a little bit eventful as well, with the aircraft rebooting in flight. Like you say, it's experimental, but you were very determined to set a firm cutoff point for your career and kind of finish it off? You know, I want to age 43. Did you ever think, well, hang on, I've had more of my bad luck now. Jack is watching over my shoulder. Maybe I can carry on. Maybe I can do more stuff. Maybe there's other things to fly and test. Ooh, you know, that's a quite sporty aeroplane. I'd quite like the look of that. Did you ever think to kind of keep going?
No, it was always right from Jack's funeral, actually. When I held his daughter's gaze in the wake, and I just that was the moment that I thought, this is not I don't want to be put in this position. I've been given a second chance. This is which is unbelievable, but going to Jack's grave every year and seeing aged 43 on his gravestone with the Fleet Air on Wings there at the Overton Church. That's as ingrained in my mind and determination as it is in his stone gravestone.
And I suppose another question here on F-35. You've said what a beast it is. Do you think it's more, or do you think it's just a stealthy supersonic Harrier or something more? One of our previous FAA guests rated it above the Spitfire as an air combat revolution, which was, I think, was pretty ballsy.
I would say that, so the F-35, I mean, air combat, it depends what, it's such a broad spectrum nowadays. Air combat goes from the very close in air combat dogfighting maneuvers, and then you take it all the way out, miles and miles out, to the distanced war fighting. The F-35 does all of it really well. Each element, I'm sure that, in fact, no, that there isn't, in certain elements that there's nothing that beats it. In some, there might be. But you would never get to that scenario where you would need to use that kind of capability. So, yeah, is it just a supersonic Harrier? Absolutely not. It's, I mean, the fact that it can hover, that's the smallest of capabilities that aircraft has. The all embodiment of this lethality, this sense of fusion, is something that no other legacy aircraft, no other aircraft in the world has. Harrier, fantastic airplane, really enjoyable to fly. It was generally as good as its pilot, whereas the F-35 is good. Yeah.
And what's the favorite aircraft you've flown then? What sort of sticks in your
air? I think the most sporty was the F-16. You feel like you've been let loose with some super sports car for an hour or so, and it does feel like you've been let loose on a racetrack. It's really, really good fun. I think the most enjoyable though would be the F-18, because it's right. Because it's just carefree handling. I would come into work and somebody would say to me, you need to go and get your currency in the F-18, because we chase in the F-18, do safety chase and photo chase. And we'd also obviously test the F-35. And so we'd be current in both aircraft. And so they say, go and fly the F-18 in about an hour. So maybe you haven't flown it for 3 months. You get the checklist out, quick refresh of the limits, quick refresh of the procedures, and then that's it. You're off. You're strapping into different equipment. You're jumping into the jet, starting the two engines, and off you go. And it will let you do whatever you want to do with it. It won't put you in any challenging positions. If you want to go vertical, as I did quite regularly, vertical with afterburner, and then just run out of energy at some point, and then the aircraft will just fall backwards vertically, and you'll see your vapor trails going past your ears as you look up to infinity, and then the aircraft will just recover itself and fly away, and then you take it on again. So yeah, it's a really, really enjoyable aeroplane, and one that you don't necessarily have to worry about.
Nathan, do we have a different breed of fighter pilots now because of the information that these platforms are able to give you now? You know, we're in an era of networks and data links and those horizons you talked about in terms of what a single F-35, you know, that circle, if you like, of influence is so much bigger than it used to be. Do you think the men and women flying these aircraft now are different even to the men and women when you were on the front line? Or do you think it's just they've changed the way that they have to operate?
Yeah, I think it's the way they operate. I don't think at all. I think we all have the same core characteristics, behaviours, the traits that make a good attack or fighter pilot. I think it's the training on the technical equipment that gets you to the place for, you know, like an F-35 sphere of influence, like you say. So, you know, the fact that I trained on the Hawk T1, you know, with its steam dials, and we smashed around Wales at low level with
compass.
Yeah, stopwatch compass. That we'd, you know, got a Sharpie on and tried to finally execute to the second time on target, which we achieved miraculously. And but now, you know, the guys are training on, guys and girls, on the Hawk T2. They've got moving maps. They've got all this synthetic enemy picture that they can bring in. So now the training is definitely, there was a chasm probably of about 20 years or so, 30 years with the Hawk T1 moving forward to the GR7, GR9 Typhoon. But now you've got the Hawk T2, which does nicely match into, you know, the legacy Typhoon or the fifth gen fighter, the F-35.
So, I mean, kind of, I think as we're kind of sort of wrapping up now, what's the reaction been to Hazard Spectrum? You know, from readers, professionals, enthusiasts. What have people said about it?
It's been fantastic. I've had really good feedback. Everybody who's read it seems to have really enjoyed it. You know, they all feel like they've been on this roller coaster ride of emotion. And also, you know, it's cracked open the door slightly on some of the Harrier operations that we've done, and also the F-35. You know, it's a rare look into the F-35 world. So no, and it's been a fantastic journey. You know, I met some great people, some people that, you know, inspired me when I was younger. You know, like John Nicol, John Peters, and it's been great. It really has, and the chance to speak to people like you, Tim and Gareth, and be able to reach a wider audience as well. It's very lucky.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point, actually, in that, you know, stuff about the F-35 is so, well, it's still so sensitive, compartmentalized, top secret. You know, anyone wanting to know anything, you know, as to what's it like to fly, it's still a bit of a, secret squirrel type of world. So great to have somebody saying, oh, well, this is how I tested it, you know, without revealing any sort of state secrets. And John Nicol as well. Obviously, that's he's gone on to be a very successful author. So Tornado, Lancaster Spitfire. Any more books planned from yourself?
We're in discussion. There's lots of things to talk about. So we'll see. Yeah, watch this space.
Right, brilliant, fantastic. Okay, and what are you up to now? So obviously, are you flying recreationally or for pleasure?
No, I'm a test and evaluation consultant, test pilot, Right. And for me now, it's mostly all about giving back. So I'm a STEM ambassador. Try and bring open aviation and all the things that advance us, as a being, which aviation does, to that next point. I'm testing and helping to evaluate and design unmanned air vehicles. And all the things that all the strange things that brings, certainly from a testing point of view, because obviously you're not sat in it, you're testing it from a ground station or elsewhere. So yeah, it's for me, it's giving back, and it's taking the next step in that technological advancement, which hopefully spills out to every person out there.
That's really, really interesting thing about sort of testing, UAVs, drones, I don't know, loyal wingmen if they're on the horizon. But how do you think we're going to replicate that sort of sixth sense of a pilot getting into an aircraft one day and going, I'm sure there's something not quite right with this thing today that is bugging me. I'm in it. I've got skin in the game. Like obviously you had skin in the game. It is my pink body is on the line, and I'm not happy with it. You haven't got that. You're not inside it. Do you think we can replicate that from the ground, at just staring at a display, giving you the vitals, going, oh, this everything looks all right, but
I will say, from what I've experienced and seen around me as well, that pilot feeling of being the person in the box, or in the cockpit, where you're, like you say, it's your pink flesh that's at risk. Actually, when you separate that and you put people in the ground control station or wherever they might be, or stood outside controlling an aircraft, actually their tolerance of risk and their acceptance of it seems to be much less, because they're not in the game, they now care more about the people on the ground and where that air system could end up if something isn't quite right. Where that goes, the old adage of jet pilots, something goes wrong with the aircraft, it's going down, and we steer it clear of the school. In the unmanned world, the sole focus is the people on the ground. So actually, I think it's a really good thing, and that awareness of risk and what the impact could be should something go wrong. Is there, if not there, more?
Fascinating, really interesting sort of thoughts there. So I think we're about to wrap up, Gareth. Unless you've got any questions.
I guess the last thing from me, Nathan, probably is, if anyone listening to this who's younger and is thinking, I want to go and do that, or if they're listening to this and their kids want to do it and their school's telling them, you need to become you need to go work in an office or whatever. What's Nathan Gray's message to those people? Just keep at it, I suppose. Believe in yourself.
Believe in yourself. Believe in your own goals. Don't give up. Don't ever give up. Try and make your own luck. So, I believe, Gareth, you joined the Air Training Corps. Flying chipmunks back then, I did. Generate your own luck, generate your own experiences, with that sole focus to get there. Don't let anyone knock you off that track. If I could do it, then, everybody out there can do it.
I think you actually said that in the book, didn't you? You obviously genuinely believe that.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
It's a great message. We it's something we try and do with the podcast, and particularly women in aviation and all the STEM stuff and everything. So important. It's so important. We've got this incredible rich history in this country, haven't we, of aeronautical history, of design and success and flying and everything, and we've got to make sure that carries on and doesn't doesn't get whittled away as, you know, so many things do, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's from those corners that people stereotypically don't go into that bring these great new ideas, you know, this out the box thinking, and that's exactly where we need to be as we move forward. So yeah, for everybody out there who's got any desire or interest in aviation design, aerospace engineering, you know, all those kind of things, I'd say, yeah, go for it and put everything you have into it.
Brilliant.
All right. Well, thanks very much for joining us, Nathan. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. What a terrific book. What a roller coaster career. Gosh. So Hazard Spectrum is out now in hardback, published by Headline.
Yeah, Headline.
So if you've not read it yet, go out, rush out to the big South American river website or your local bookshop and go and pick it up. And Nathan, you're not around you're not visible on social media or things like that, so we can't ask you where you hang out. But really, really great to have you on the show, and hopefully, you know, maybe we'll get you on again as a return guest in the future.
Yeah, and if anyone listening has got anything, we can obviously pass messages on to you. So if anyone's got any feedback for Nathan, we'll make sure they land in your inbox, Nathan.
Great, thank you, Gareth.
Brilliant. All right, well, it's goodbye from me. So it's goodbye from Gareth.
Thanks ever so much, Nathan. Goodbye.
And goodbye from Nathan.
Yeah, thank you very much. Speak to you soon.
Yeah, and see you next time on Aviation Extended.
Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.